Erev Tov, it's a rhyme Tov, depending on where people might be. And nice to see everybody. Hope all is well. Welcome to part five and the Torah in Motion Zoom series on biblical commentaries they never taught you in yeshiva. So after Moshe Mendelssohn, who they for sure didn't teach you in yeshiva, we'll introduce someone who they for sure didn't teach his biblical commentary in yeshiva, but they may have mentioned his rabbinic commentary. I don't know, even that, not so much. Rav David Zvi Hoffman, the great German leader of the turn of the late 19th century, turn of the 20th century. So with that little introduction, Dr. Lukshin, we're looking forward.
Thank you very much. As Rabbi Kelman said, this is the fifth session, but it's the third commentator. We're dedicating to each commentator two sessions. And so to review who the two that we've seen so far are, we saw Shmuel David Luzzatto in Italy in the 19th century. Then we went back to the 18th century to Moses Mendelssohn. And now we're moving on to Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman, who flourished in the beginning of the 20th century. Rabbi Hoffman is different from the previous two commentators that we looked at in a number of ways. First of all, he is a great Talmid Chacham, and he's the author of some really interesting responsa, opinions in Jewish law. And on the other hand, he has an amazing secular education. Now, certainly, Shadal had an amazing secular education, but he was really self-taught. And Mendelssohn also was mostly self-taught, but Rav David Zvi Hoffman had a PhD, and he was a Talmid Chacham. And we'll see various things that make him interesting, but he is, just to tell you the bottom line of the of these sessions, he is the first rabbi, and one of the only rabbis who took biblical criticism seriously enough to address biblical criticism in his commentaries on the Torah and to try to refute biblical criticism. He was born in 1843. He was born in Verbo in Hungary, and Hungary was part of the Austrian Empire back then. Verbo is actually in Slovakia today, but we would still consider him to be a Hungarian, and that's what he thought of himself as we'll see in one of the texts we will see in a few minutes. His father died when he was just 5 years old. He studied with some very impressive people, both from the more modern circles and from some less modern circles, but he studied with Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer in his youth in Eisenstadt in Hungary. And when Hildesheimer left Hungary to go to Germany, Hoffman also left. And one of his first jobs was teaching at a school headed by Rabbi Shimshon Rafael Hirsch. He didn't agree with Hirsch about all the issues. So we'll talk about the disagreements that he had with Rabbi Hirsch, but in many ways they shared many values. He studied philosophy, history, and Semitic languages at the University of Vienna and at the Friedrich Wilhelm University in Berlin and at the University of Tübingen, where he received a doctorate degree for academic Talmud studies. And we'll talk a little bit more about the relevance of academic Talmud studies for our topic here. In 1873, Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer founds the Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin and hires Hoffman as a teacher there. And after Hildesheimer dies, Hoffman becomes the head of that school. He had a reputation as being punctilious in observance while being lenient in some of his religious decisions. I wanted to try, before we look at his commentary, I wanted to talk a little bit about the personality. And, you know, he He was, as I said, a great Talmid Chacham who dealt with some of the issues of modernity that some of which still trouble us today. One of the people who attends these classes regularly sent me an email and said, wasn't he the one who wrote that famous tshuva about a Kohen marrying a woman who converts to Judaism? There was a case that was brought to him where there was a Jewish man, a Kohen, who was married to a Gentile woman, and the Jew started taking his Judaism a little more seriously, and his wife wanted to convert to Judaism. And the general principle of conversion is that you convert somebody to Judaism if they are willing to observe the mitzvot, but if they say that they're not going to observe the mitzvot, then you don't convert them. And if this woman converts to Judaism, she wants to continue to be married to this man who's a Kohen, and a Kohen is not supposed to be married to a convert, so are you allowed to convert a woman like this to Judaism? And Rabbi Hoffman says, yes, it is permitted to convert a woman like this to Judaism, and offers some learned arguments why it is permitted. On another issue of modernity, an issue that's kind of close to my own heart, on the issue of, is a Jew allowed to teach Torah to a Gentile? There are lines in the Gemara that say that it is not permissible to teach Torah to a Gentile. Rabbi Kelman, I imagine you don't go checking who's signing up for the Torah and Motion talks about whether all of them are Jewish. And certainly when I taught at York University, I wasn't able to have a policy that I would be teaching Torah only to Jews. There's a famous tshuva of Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg specifically about teaching in university. Apparently, he was offered at one point in his life, he was offered a position in a university. One time when I was lecturing about this, somebody said that Rabbi Weinberg's tshuva presumably says that it's okay to teach Jewish studies in a university, but only if it's in a tenure-track position. But that wasn't his answer, but Rabbi Weinberg did find a heter. Rabbi Hoffman, on the other hand, he dealt with a different kind of issue. In Germany, they had religious instruction as part of public school education, and the people who were Jewish were given a Jewish teacher. There were hours, if you're going to a public school, part of the time in public school would be for religious instruction, and the students were divided in groups by their religion. And a Jewish teacher who was teaching in a public school turned to Rabbi Hoffman and said, I have a student who was assigned to my class, and his father is Jewish and his mother is not Jewish. And the father wants him to attend the Judaism classes. And is it permissible for me to teach Torah to this young man who is not halachically Jewish? And surprisingly, even though Rabbi Hoffman is lenient about many issues, he wasn't lenient on that issue. And he figured out some kind of way that here are some things that you could teach, and here, but if you're teaching anything that's related to Shmirat Mitzvot, you should try to convince the father that, you know, that these weeks we're going to be teaching something about Shmirat Mitzvot, and since you don't observe the Mitzvot, you don't want your son attending these because there's going to be tension in the home if he learns about Shmirat Mitzvot and you people aren't Shomrei Mitzvot. Just to make the character of Rabbi Hoffman clear, I should say I know somebody who's writing a PhD right now on David Zvi Hoffman's responsa and halachic writings. A man named Emmanuel Block, who's a friend and neighbor of my son in Manhattan has been working on, and I often enjoy talking with Emmanuel about Rabbi Tzvi Hoffman as a halachist. And I thought I'd just share with you, this is one of my favorite tshuvot, favorite rabbinic responsa in the whole canon of responsa literature. It's not about Bible, but I hope you'll forgive me for giving you this like introduction that shows something about the world in which Rabbi Hoffman lived and in which we live today. Here's the question that was asked to him. B'minyan shelanu yesh echad o shnayim shemchalalim Shabbat befar hesya lo levad bimlachtam ki im gam osim mugmar. In our minyan, there are one or two men who desecrate Shabbat in public, not just by going to work. They even smoke on Shabbat. Lasot mugmar really means to burn incense. It's a Talmudic phrase, but I assume that what it means here, it's not that they, I don't know that burning incense was all that common in early 20th century Germany, but sometimes people would make a distinction between people who go to work on Shabbat because of parnasa, because there's just no way of making a living unless the people were claiming. But if smoking on Shabbat was seen as an example of total rejection of Shabbat, afilo kiddush v'havdala einam osim, they don't even make kiddush and havdalah. Isharu letzorfam leminyan. So they come to shul, and can you count these people in a minyan? A question that's, as I said, was relevant in early 20th century Germany and is relevant in all countries still today. There are people who come to shul who are not Shabbat observant. So he gives the answer, and he starts with the Prima Gadim and the Tshuvat Chacham Tzvi and the Magen Avram, and he lists sources all that take a stringent position on it. And that he looks at the previous literature on the subject, and Mechalel Shabbat Befar Hesya Ein Mitzarfin Leminyan, you can't, somebody who publicly desecrates Shabbat. This category, it's a Talmudic category, not just somebody who desecrates Shabbat, but somebody who desecrates Shabbat in public. And that these people who smoke in public and whose stores are open in public, are desecrating Shabbat in public. And so it would seem from the sources that Rabbi Hoffman cites that Ein Mitzarfim Leminyan. But then he goes on, from all the from all this, we see that following the law, one who desecrates Shabbat in public cannot be counted in minyan. Ach, bazman hazeh nohagim lahakel af be'eretz ungarin umikol shekein be'eretz Ashkenaz. This is my favorite, I think, Kal Vachomer, written in the 20th century. The custom is to be lenient nowadays in Hungary. How much more so in Germany? Look, I come from Hungary, and in Hungary, I know that they count non-religious Jews who come to shul. They count them for the minyan, and so, of course, in Germany. But he's trying to figure out, yeah, look at the texts, and the texts don't suggest that it's allowed. And then he tells a story. I remember, I'll read it in English just to save time. I remember that one time a member of our community, Kahal Adat Yisrael, who kept his store open on Shabbat, became an avel. And of course, the custom is that when somebody loses a parent, then they are the shaliach tzibur, they lead the services on weekdays. And he led the services in our community shul. So he was an avail. He used to have a store open on Shabbat. Just, you know, something that can happen in any city in Canada or the United States or all over the world these days, that somebody who works on Shabbat loses a parent and decides to come to shul. And if they have the ability to be a shliach tzibur, they might wish to be the shliach tzibur. And Rabbi Hoffman continues, our gabbai knew how to placate him, telling him that it was best that he not lead the service, as other congregants might gossip about him. Agabaya dalaratzoto tol of haisosha lo yared od mipnei shakahal yiranenu alseh. So that's how he convinced him not to be a shaliach tzibur. But what happened? V'achar kach halach ze aish lebed hakneset shel chever shas, v'afsha agabay desham haya ish chared v'yirei Elokim, hi nichol l'yared lifnei ha-teva b'li minya. So he went to the frumer shul in town. He was going to Rabbi Hoffman's kind of modern Orthodox shul. And then he said, okay, he went to the more charedi-like shul in town, and he told them that he was an avail. And he wanted to be the shaliach tzibur, and they said, okay, you can be the shaliach tzibur. So Rabbi Hoffman went to talk to the gabbai at the Haredi shul. When I asked the gabbai why he didn't prevent the man from leading the services, he answered that from time immemorial, miyamim kadmonim, from time immemorial, the custom here in his Beit Midrash is that they don't prevent people whose stores are open on Shabbat from leading the services. He says, "Dos is the minhag." And since the rabbis of the Beit Midrash were famous scholars, we could assume that they had valid reasons. So that's what the gabbai said to him. Look, there were great rabbanim who davened in this Beit Midrash, and Jews whose stores were open on Shabbat used to come here, and they used to lead the service. And of course, leading the service is even a step beyond counting towards the minyan. So even this was allowed. And then Rabbi Hoffman starts speculating what might be the logic behind this approach. Perhaps they relied on the opinion of Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, the Jews who desecrate Shabbat these days are somewhat akin to tinok shenishba leben hanochrim, children who were captured by Gentiles, who were taken into captivity by Gentiles. The idea kind of being that we're all educated by the society in which we grow up, and the village in which we grow up gives us our values, and these days the society doesn't really teach Shabbat the way it used to. So since for our sins, most Jews in our country desecrate Shabbat. So it isn't that this child has actually been hijacked, kidnapped by the Gentiles, but he's kind of been kidnapped by society. He's been brought up by society as a result of the societal pressure. They don't intend to deny the essential principles of Judaism when they desecrate Shabbat. That in the days when the Jewish community, everybody in the Jewish community, or virtually everybody in the Jewish community, observe Shabbat, then desecrating Shabbat had a different meaning to it than it does today. Similarly, Rabbi Meshulam Zalman HaKohen, I wasn't able to figure out who this is. I found some Meshulam Zalman HaKohen who lived before the 19th century, but that Meshulam Zalman HaKohen could not have been quoting Rav Yosef Shaul Natanson, so maybe it was his grandson or something. Rav Meshulam Zalman HaKohen told me in the name of Rabbi Yosef Shaul Natanson that Jews from America are not considered invalid. That ha'anashim me'America einam nifsalim al yedei chilul Shabbat shalahem, because they desecrate Shabbat, since they are all like children who were captured by Gentiles. So all of you who are in Canada or the United States, Rabbi Yosef Shaul Natanson is claiming that you are all in that society where religious observance was never particularly strong. They have the category of tinok shenishba levein hanochrim. Then, after offering these arguments, Rabbi Hoffman still says, in any case, a person who decides to be lenient and count such people in a minyan has support for that position. But those who are able to go to another shul, this was really surprising to me, that after offering these arguments, he says,
But if you can find another shul, if you can find a place to daven where everybody is actually observant without insulting anyone, obviously it is better that they not rely on this leniency and that they daven with kosher Jews. Pshita demiyot tov shlo yismoch al heter zev yidpalel im anashim sherim. It's best if the minyan consists of people of 10 men who accept halacha. And then he offers another argument why one might consider being lenient on an issue like this. Od yesh snif lahakel de bismanenu lo mikre mechalel shabbat befarhesya kevan sheruban osin kein. So another possible argument for leniency. People whose stores are open on Shabbat are not considered anymore to be in the category of public desecrators of Shabbat, because now this is what most Jews do. Public desecration of Shabbat means going against the community. But if the community is not observing Shabbat, then you are not in the category of a public desecrator of Shabbat. Granted that when the majority of the community behaves properly and some individuals have the chutzpah to go against communal norms, they can be considered to have denied the Torah, acted abominably in a high-handed manner, and separated themselves from the Jewish people. That's what it meant in the past, this category of mechalel Shabbat befarhesya, publicly desecrating Shabbat. It meant going against established communal norms. And then he writes, however now, since because of our sins, the majority break the rules, takanatam kalkalatam, their iniquity works for their benefit. The fact that the situation is so bad actually makes it better. Hayachid choshev she'en zo avera gedola kol kach ve'en sarich la'asot betzina ufarhesya shelo. Individuals who desecrate Shabbat think that the sin isn't so serious and that there's no reason to hide it. So their public desecration is now like private desecration. They're not going against communal standards. And now the real chop of this tshuva. In fact, it is the God-fearing Jews nowadays who are called the ones who separate from the community. We are the ones that Mechalel Shabbat Befarhesya, that category of publicly desecrating Shabbat, means a person who goes against communal norms and behaves so differently from the community. And Rabbi Hoffman says, so, and who is it who goes against communal norms these days? It's us. It's we from people who go against communal norms. Hayireim kruim bismanenu prushim umuvdalim v'haposhim heim hahochim b'derech call Haaretz. The people who desecrate Shabbat are the ones who are following what have been established these days as communal norms, because the community at large are not observing are not observing Shabbat. But we are the ones, actually, who have separated ourselves from the community. And because of that, this category of Mechalel Shabbat Befarhesya, as someone who separated from himself from the community, no longer exists. We see someone here struggling with his attempt to be totally committed to halacha, taking extremely seriously what many of us might consider today a Haredi kind of approach, because most of the modern Orthodox synagogues that I think many of the people here attend would never think of not counting somebody in a minyan, a Jewish person who walks into the minyan. They wouldn't think about doing this, but Rabbi Hoffman takes the stringent sources extremely seriously here, but he offers some interesting arguments, and he's got what I really like about this is the understanding that he's living in a different kind of world than the world of the rabbis of the Talmud. We all realize that,
But how often does a rabbi writing a tshuva write like this so clearly, that the fact that the world is so different these days and the Jewish community is so different these days might result in us having a different approach to things? Okay, so this is just like an introduction to Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman, the halachist. Hoffman also, in addition to being a great halachist, he was a critical scholar. He was a true Talmudist and a halachist, but he believed in academic work in critical Talmud studies. And so before we actually look at what he says about critical biblical criticism, I wanted to give you a little sample of his critical Talmud studies. I think somebody has somebody is unmuted and has some noise in the background. If you have noise in your background, please be sure to mute yourself. Hoffman wrote this book on Hamishnah Harishona, and it was translated from the German by Paul Forsheimer, and it's available on the web. It's funny, Rabbi Kelman, you mentioned last week that, or 2 weeks ago, that you learned for the first time that Moses Mendelssohn had written his commentary on the Torah in Hebrew. And Shadal also wrote his commentary on the Torah in Hebrew. And most of Rav David Zvi Hoffman's writings, other than his straight halachic writings, were in German. And he wrote about Talmud in German, and he wrote his commentary on the Torah also in German. And so I have here a selection from a section of his that shows you a little bit about his critical study of the Talmud. You know, we're all acquainted with the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. I've started here with Pirkei Avot, chapter 1, Mishnah 15, going through to chapter 2, Mishnah 4, up to Mishnah 15. The first Mishnah in Pirkei Avot is, of course, Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai, Sarav Yoshua. Starts with Moshe at Har Sinai, and then Yoshua. And then everything goes chronologically, generation by generation, until we get to Hillel and Shammai. Hillel and Shammai are there in Mishnah 14 and 15. And then we have, just looking at the names that follow here, after Hillel and Shammai, we have Rabban Gamliel, and then we have Shimon Beno, Shimon, the son of Rabban Gamliel. And then we have Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. Wait a second. Is that the same guy as in Mishnah 17? Is Mishnah 16, Mishnah Tetzayin is Rabban Gamliel. Mishnah 17 is Shimon Beno, the son, they don't call him rabbi. And then Mishnah 18 is Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. And then we have Rebbe, that's in the first Mishnah of the next chapter, is Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And then we have Rabban Gamliel, Beno Shel Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. There were actually three Rabban Gamliels, and this is the third Rabban Gamliel. This is the son of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And he says a couple of things in Mishnah Bet, and in Mishnah Gimel, and in Mishnah Dalet. And then we have Hillel Omer. Wait a second. We had Hillel back in the beginning. Okay, so that's the problem that anybody who studies Pirkei Avot and looks at this order of the generations just has to end up scratching their heads when they look at this. So let's see what Rabbi Hoffman writes about this. Let's just start here. Is this clear enough, or should I make it a little bigger, Rabbi Kelman?
A little bigger would be a little better, but yeah.
Good.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. A careful study of the treatise reveals immediately numerous difficulties which call definitely for a critical analysis. In the first chapter, there is an important gap between Hillel and Shammai and the following Mishnah, Rabban Gamliel. Three generations are missing: Shimon ben Hillel, Rabban Gamliel Hazakein, and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Hazakein. So Hoffman is assuming, and he'll argue this in the continuation, that after Hillel, they don't go to the first Rabban Gamliel, they jump to the second Rabban Gamliel, and so there are three generations that are totally missing here. Rabban Gamliel's son is conspicuously mentioned only without the title of rabbi. And then immediately after in Mishnah 18, he is mentioned as Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. So wait a second. So is it Shimon? Is it your friend Shimon that you don't call him rabbi? Or is it Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel? If we were to follow the, as we shall see, erroneous opinion of some commentators, according to which Mishnah 16:17 referred to Rabban Gamliel HaZakein and his son Shimon, then the absence of any title for Shimon is all the more striking and the difficulties only mount. In that case, two gaps would appear, one between Hillel and Rabban Gamliel the first, because it was two generations later was Rabban Gamliel the first, and again, between the two Shimons, from the first Shimon to his grandson Shimon. Rabban Gamliel II, the grandfather of the editor of the Mishnah, would be missing, and then the more famous perhaps Rabban Gamliel II would be missing from the list. If you're not following every one of the details here, that's okay, but you can hear the music of what Hoffman's doing here. After the dynasty of the Nasi'im has been listed down to Rabban Gamliel III, the son of the editor of the Mishnah, Hillel appears once more. There is no doubt that this is Hillel HaZakein and not, as some would have it, a later Hillel. There is a Hillel among the Amoraim, and there is a, some people have suggested that maybe that second Hillel isn't the same as the first Hillel. That couldn't be the case because Mishnah chapter 2, Mishnah 6 is expressly attributed to the elder Hillel in the Gemara and in Avot to Rabbi Natan. So we can't say that this is the later Hillel. Otherwise, one would have to shift 2:6 to chapter 1 as do some codes. Okay. Why now have Hillel's sayings been distributed over two places? Starting with chapter 3, all chronological order seems to be lacking. Even a topical arrangement would be hard to discover. And anybody who teaches Pirkei Avot, and I know Rabbi Kelman, you teach Pirkei Avot, we all teach Pirkei Avot from time to time. Finding the connection sometimes between one Mishnah and another is a real challenge. And the fifth chapter has no connection with the preceding ones at all. We cannot see why it has been attached to the treatise of Avot, inasmuch as most of the sayings by far are not attributed to any of the Tanaim. These conspicuous features lead us, never mind the sixth chapter, which everybody says that's a later addition to Pirkei Avot, but even looking at the first five chapters that we generally think of as being consistent work, this piece of writing that was written and to be read as a unit, these conspicuous features lead us to the conviction that the Mishnaic treatise of Avot has undergone many manifold rearrangements. They also call for a reconstruction. Sorry, of the original plan. What's Rabbi Hoffman doing here? He's finding us like the original Avot. Looking at the Avot that we have, he says, I am going to reconstruct what the original source was. So I'm going to reconstruct the original plan of Avot and also the various transformations that it went through. There is one fact that makes this text task easier for us, aside from our Mishnah, one other version of the Mishnaic treatise of Avot has been preserved. The Agadah collection known as Avot Rabbi Natan has long been recognized as the Tosefta of the Mishnaic treatise of Avot. There are a number of typos here in this translation, but I think it's clear anyways. It was also known as Tosefta de Masechet, misspelled here. The typist made a mistake. Tosefta de Masechet Avot. It contains a running commentary in additions to the Mishnah of Avot, but it becomes immediately obvious that this Tosefta does not have our Mishnah as its basis, but rather another version that had probably been edited by Rabbi Natan. This other version of Avot, to be called here, the Mishnah of Avot de Rabbi Natan, can be easily reconstructed from Avot de Rabbi Natan, if not in all details, then at least in its essential constituent parts. So what do we have here? You know, put it bluntly, we have here the source theory of Pirkei Avot, that we look at Pirkei Avot, at this conglomerate that we call Pirkei Avot now, and we say to ourselves, it's made up of, there was a redactor who came along and took from various different collections that were called Avot, and he put them together, and I am going to take my scissors and paste, and I'm going to cut out the pieces, and I am going to reconstruct the original sources from which Avot was made. It's possible the Rabbi Hoffman would not like the way I am rephrasing what he's saying here, but I would argue that this is what he is doing here. To put it even more bluntly, he is doing to the Mishnah what many biblical critics do to the Bible. They look at it and say, well, this doesn't fit with this, and this is, well, we have to look at the sources, and we have to divide it up into the four sources. Okay, let's just read a little further, then, at least in its essential constituent parts, because its text is in most cases quoted in its entirety, or at least in part, in the commentary of Avot. Accordingly, the Mishnah of Avot of Rabbi Natan was composed of the following parts. So here's what the original Mishnah of Avot looked like. The oldest fathers of the tradition until Hillel and Shammai, identical with our Mishnah Avot, chapter 1 to 15. Only for Hillel, his saying in 2:6, and one more had been added. Immediately after Hillel and Shammai, there followed Rabbi Yochanan HaZaken Kibel Me Hillel the Shammai. That's in chapter 2, Mishnah 8 to 14. We have to reconstruct the source that way. That was the original Mishnah Avot. It skipped from 1:15 to 2:8, and five of his, of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's outstanding disciples. And after that, several old Tanaim up to the time of Rabbi Akiva are enumerated, Akavya ben Hillel, ben Mahalalel, and all of those. All of these names are also found in our Mishnah, but in a quite different sequence. But I'm going to rearrange the Mishnah and create this document and say this document is the original document of the Mishnah. And then follow, for the greater part, later Tanaim, also some earlier ones without a recognizable order and their sayings, only a few of which occur in our Mishnah. And then, so he reconstructs what the Mishnah used to look like. And I thought it was important to look at this before we go on to what he does with the Bible, because I would say that for Hoffman, the critical method of looking at a text and trying to find what the sources are is an acceptable method. It is just that he argues that the biblical critics did it poorly. And before we look at it, we will finally get to what he does with the biblical critics in just 1 minute. Before that, I wanted to share with you a joke that I once heard here in Israel. There was a lecture given by a religious professor, and another religious professor who was there was not all that pleased with the lecture. And in order to explain the line, I have to teach you a little Talmudic text. There's a line in the Talmud that says, "Kol da asar lan rachmana, shara lan kavate." Everything that God prohibited to us, he permitted to us something that's similar. Asar lan dama, we're not allowed to eat blood. Shara lan kavta, but God allows us to eat the liver and get a little bit of the taste of blood when you eat the liver, is what this text is suggesting. Chelev behema, chelev chaya. God doesn't allow us to eat the forbidden fat, the chelev of a domesticated animal, but does allow us to eat the chelev of a chaya, of an undomesticated animal. Chazir mocha deshivuta. God prohibited pork, but he permitted the brain of a shibuta fish. Never eaten pork or the brain of a shibuta fish, so I don't really know whether the brain of a shibuta fish is the same taste. Maybe we would say today he forbade bacon, but he allowed us to eat bakos. Eshet ish grusha b'chaye ba'ala. God prohibited sexual intercourse with the wife of another man, but he did permit somebody to marry a divorced woman in her previous husband's lifetime. And that gives you a little bit of the feeling of an eshet ish, is what this Gemara is suggesting. Anyways, I told you that I was at this lecture given by a religious professor in Talmud studies, and another religious professor who was there when we walked out of the lecture said to me, "Kol ma da asar lan rachmana shara lan kavate." Everything that God forbade to us, he allowed us to do something similar. And he said, "Asar lan bikorat hamikra, shara lan bikorat sifrut chachamim." That God forbade us to do biblical criticism, but he allowed us to do criticism of rabbinic literature. And so the professor here in Israel today, who a religious Jew who was doing critical study of Talmudic texts, it isn't something new. It was something going on in the beginning of the 20th century that David Zvi Hoffman was doing critical studies of Talmudic texts and looking for sources in Talmudic literature, but still opposing opposing biblical criticism. And my argument is, so there are those people who just say he's inconsistent and he's just a frumie and he's an apologist, and the reason that he doesn't accept biblical criticism is because his whole edifice would topple. But I really don't believe that's the case. I really believe that Rabbi Hoffman had and felt that he had, and I agree with him that he had, a number of very strong arguments against the logic of biblical criticism. And finally, we will begin to look at some of his arguments, which I have taken here from his book, Die wichtigsten Instanzen gegen die Graf-Wellhausen'sche Hypothese, the main arguments against the Graf-Wellhausen hypothesis. And this is from Dr. Carla Schulzbach's MA thesis. Dr. Schulzbach is with us, and maybe at the end in the question period we'll give her a chance to for rebuttal if I've said anything incorrect. But I'm extremely grateful that Carla wrote this MA thesis, made the translation of this book available, and even more than that, put it on the web so that all of us can have access to this. And so I just want to look at a couple of the arguments that Hoffman makes against the documentary hypothesis. For those of you who don't know, the documentary hypothesis argues that a redactor came along and found four documents. This is the simplest version of it: J, E, P, and D. And P in the classical understanding of this theory. None of these documents have ever been found. They are just reconstructed documents. P is understood as coming from after the Babylonian exile, and it includes all the priestly sections, most of Sefer Vayikra or all of Sefer Vayikra and various other sections that deal with priests, and it's seen as being like the latest of the documents. And Hoffman puts together a number of arguments about how really strange it is to say that P is the latest of the documents. He talks first about the Aron HaBrit, the Ark of the Covenant. The other parts of the Pentateuch, J, E, and D, also mention the Ark of the Covenant, but nowhere does it appear as such an important cultic object as in the priestly code. PC means priestly code. It's the first holy implement which God commands to be built. The ark is covered by the kaporet with the two kruvim. God's presence manifests itself there. This is all from sections that the critics say come from P. The holy ark must be equipped with staves, with badim, by means of which it can be carried by the Levites after it was carefully covered by the priests, as things are. It is generally agreed that long before the destruction of the first temple, the ark with the tables of the law was no longer there in the sanctuary, and that when building the second temple, nobody thought of putting a holy ark in the Holy of Holies. There is no holy ark anymore. Wait a second. You're saying that P is from after Churban HaBayit, it's from after the Babylonian exile, but you're saying that the section of the Bible that makes the biggest deal out of the Aron HaBrit is P. And why would, therefore, and that the atonement on the Day of Atonement no longer took place at the Kaporet, that's what the sources tell us, but at the Even HaShtiyah, which had taken the place of the Ark. Why would the author of the priestly code have included the Holy Ark in his legislation? Why would he write that the way to effect atonement of the people on Yom HaKippurim is through the Aron, when the Aron doesn't exist anymore? It's totally illogical. And if you would say that he did this in order to put an archaic stamp on his work, he wants it to look old. He's trying to pretend that he's from Bayit Rishon, and he was therefore prompted to mention the Ark's construction. What could have moved him to associate the Great Atonement Festival with a holy implement, which in his time doesn't exist anymore? Like he's saying that the way that you cause atonement is with this Aron, and it doesn't exist anymore. Another argument, the Urim and the Tumim and the anointing of the high priest. Only the priestly code mentions the making of the Urim and Tumim and their purpose. It is true that it does not state what the Urim and Tumim actually consisted of. Nevertheless, their purpose is determined precisely when it says, Aaron shall bear the names of the children of Israel in the Choshen HaMishpat on his heart. The part of the Chumash that the critics say is P, says even clearly, and he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. At his word shall they go out, and at his word they shall come in, both he and all the children of Israel with him, even all the congregation. The purpose of the Urim and Tumim then was to transmit God's will through the high priest to the leaders of the people and conform to that which they would have to act. We see that unless it was the author's intention to wrap this holy institution in a veil of secrecy and mystery, that he could have told much more about the Urim and Tumim, but we see lots of stories about consulting the Urim and Tumim during Bayit Rishon, but during Bayit Sheni, we didn't have the Urim and Tumim. And so if we're saying that P is the text that tells you how to make the Urim and Tumim, it says that the Urim and Tumim are, it does not make logical sense. It has now been determined that after the exile,
And in the Second Temple period, Urim and Tumim were no longer in existence, and a matter which required a divine ruling had to be postponed until there will stand up a priest with Urim and Tumim, as it says in Ezra and Nehemiah. So we see that in Bayit Sheni, they feel the loss of the Urim and Tumim. So why would it be Davka P at the beginning of Bayit Sheni, who's giving all the details about the importance of the Urim and Tumim? If the priestly code had only been composed during the exile, its author, according to the critics, was a priest, and therefore also had the interest of the priests at heart, and especially intended to raise the high priest's prestige, nevertheless did not present the high priest as bearer of the Urim and Tumim, which did not exist in his time. Through this deficiency, the high priest was at risk to ruin his entire reputation. You know, according to the critics, the author of P is a priest, and he really wants the Kohen Gadol to have a lot of honor. And so why does he say that the high priest ought to be walking around with the Urim and Tumim if there weren't any Urim and Tumim in the beginning of Bayit Sheni? And he provides the same argument about the Shemen HaMishcha, and this is, we will see more examples next week, but this is what he tries to do to show the illogic of the way in which biblical critics apply critical method, which, as we see, Hoffman accepts, but he thinks that the critics applied critical method to the Torah in an unacceptable and illogical manner. I think that maybe I will stop here and allow some questions from the chat, or Rabbi Kelman, if you'd like to say.
Rabbi, yeah. May I ask, while still on the same topic, sure. There's been a lot of development even in the world of biblical criticism in the last 100 years. And, you know, Wellhausen's original ideas are not, have also undergone a critique. How relevant would you say Rav David Zvi Hoffman's commentary is to in the 21st century as opposed to in the 20th century?
Okay, it's not as relevant as it was in the beginning of the 20th century, but to the best of my knowledge, the majority of critics still date P late. And there are some who give it an earlier date. And so these specific arguments that we just looked at, I think, are strong, logical arguments against one critic here in Israel, Yechezkel Kaufman, argued that P has to be earlier, but his theory never actually caught on among critics. Most critics still say that P is late. So these arguments that we just read right now, I think, are as relevant as they ever were.
And how common were, like, how big an issue was this in German Orthodox? You alluded to the fact that he and Hirsch had very differing views. Obviously, Hirsch had a very non-academic approach to everything Jewish. I'm just curious, was your typical Orthodox Jew in Germany, was he concerned with these issues in biblical criticism? They needed Hoffman. You know, Hirsch came to respond to the needs of the day in his oratory and his writings. Was Hoffman doing the same, or is he just an academic in the ivory tower, so to speak, if I can use that term, in writing what he did? Because he felt it's important, but it didn't really impact on the community at large.
I don't consider myself a big expert on Germany in the beginning of the 20th century. I'll just say that, and then I'll answer your question. My understanding is that it wasn't a central concern of people in the Jewish community, and that there were some intellectuals, just like today, there are various people who, I would ask you, Rabbi Kelman, how central is biblical criticism?
Correct, 100%. That's exactly right. Most people don't care about it.
That's right. But there are some intellectuals who care about it. And there's somebody like Hoffman who's using the same kind of method for looking through a text and saying, what was the original text? What was the sources? How did people change this text over the years? And so he knows that the biblical critics from a from a style point of view, are doing the same thing that he did with rabbinic literature. And there, that's why he feels that he has to explain why what they are doing has been done poorly and illogically.
Okay, Marjorie's asking, I'll get to all the questions. I know that's the last one, but if you want to compare maybe his approach to Josh Berman, who just, you know, recently came out with his book Ani Maamin, that you know, Corin has been pushing on biblical criticism, and maybe Josh Berman is a academic Jewish scholar, also a fine Talmud Chacham, you know, an Orthodox rabbi, and they just wrote a book on biblical criticism. So I don't know if you've had a chance to read the book yet, so maybe it's not a fair question.
I have read the book, and I actually wrote a review of it in the Jerusalem Post. For those of you who are in Toronto, I'll just say that you might remember, or other places in Canada, you might remember that I used to write a review once a month for the Canadian Jewish News, Alav HaShalom, and right. I sent in my review of Professor Josh Berman's book, and the same day they wrote back to me and said, we've decided to close the newspaper, So I published that review in the Jerusalem Post. I think that Josh Berman, he really knows modern biblical criticism extremely well, and he has some very strong arguments in that book. I had some minor criticisms of the book. You can still look it up online. You can read my review. It's there. Just write Martin Losh and Joshua Berman, and you'll get you'll get that review. There were some things about the book that I disagreed with, but I think that he has some very strong arguments against biblical criticism there, and he is going in the tradition of David Zvi Hoffman.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning. Not too many questions. David Eisen wants to know, did Rav Hoffman, Rav David, officiate at the wedding of the Kohen and convert? Now, I didn't know that Rav Gorney said officiated with execution Helen Zeidman to a Kohen following her conversion.
Rabbi Hoffman did not officiate. He makes that very clear. I'm permitting a very good question that you.
I mean, it's kind of similar what he did in the shul. I'm permitting you to daven there, but really, it's better to daven in a quote unquote a firmer shul. So it's very interesting. But I can totally understand why Rav Gorin had a very different approach. You know, it's sort of like the rabbi gives a hechsher but won't eat there. Like that's a whole different story. Okay, somebody, I guess, raising a question, Zava, on the Gemara. Okay, I'll just say what she says. A divorced woman is allowed to remarry for the benefit of the man. You know, the Gemara says, we're matter the Eshet Ish, we're matter the divorced woman. So what about the woman? So I don't know if you want to comment, I'll comment.
I understand where that question is coming from, and
if I may, the Talmud is written from a male perspective. That's 100% true. The Bible, it's just that's the way it is. I think, you know, it's we don't think that way. I totally agree. We wouldn't. That's how I don't know that it's a fair criticism. It's just that's how society was. Everything was, and I don't even think Gemara means it there even totally either. Gemara's saying in a particular context, Gemara asked this, allowed this, that. So it came up. But yes, I agree. I do hear the comment. Was there any other points here?
Whoever that is, just sent the link to my review of Joshua Berman, so you can find it there in the chat. Thank you, B.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. That's it. So thank you. We look forward to next week. We'll pick up on the theme of Rav David Zvi Hoffman. 2:15 today, Eastern Standard Time, 9:15 in Israel. Lori Nova continues with the second of her series, planning 13-part series on men, women, and ritual, a textual analysis. It's really a fascinating shiur last week. I think everybody did really, really excellent. Going through the sources and objectively, today it's Tzitzit. Today and next week on Tzitzit, that's 2:15, same Zoom channel. I assume you'll take a break, but if you want to stick around for 3 hours, actually, I'm going to end the meeting, so you can't stick around for 3 hours or 2 hours. And then at 8 p.m. this evening, Moshe Sokolov continuing his weekly shiur on the Haftarah of the week. And then tomorrow, we don't have the shiur in the morning. Shuli Mishkin finished her series, but tomorrow evening, Rabbi Michael Whitman from Montreal will be giving the shiur in Parshat HaShavua. So we got three more shiurim coming up ahead. We look forward to seeing you, learning with you. Everybody be well and enjoy, and nice to see everybody. And thank you, Dr. Lakshin, and have a wonderful week, and welcome to your new apartment.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay.